Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chicago hot dogs, Buffalo chicken wings, Philly cheesesteaks, and then there's Detroit frog legs.
You know, it started out strictly as kind of a wild game mom and pop thing where people would go out and hunt frog legs and bring them into the restaurants and the roadhouses. But after a while, it was a national industry. And the number, I thought it was eye-popping. They would do 1,000 dozen a week during the season. So they were doing roughly 200 to 400,000 frog legs per restaurant. And there were hundreds of these places that were selling frog legs.
That's Detroit food writer Bill Loomis with perhaps a controversial idea for a Detroit culinary renaissance. More coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Using scientific equipment and materials like centrifuges and liquid nitrogen is not a new occurrence in the restaurant world. It's what today's modernist cuisine is based on. Transforming molecules is transforming molecules, whether it's in a lab experiment or with an experimental creme brulee. But what happens when you pair two personalities, a chef and a card-carrying scientist? Well, reporter Ari Daniel was invited into the kitchen of Kimball House outside of Atlanta to observe.
Just outside of Atlanta, there's a special place called the Kimball House.
Our first goal as chefs is to nourish people.
Jeffrey Wall is the co-executive chef at the restaurant. The other chef is his friend, Philip Meeker.
And it's about presenting something new, a new experience.
That new experience involves the freshest and most local of ingredients, the use of modernist techniques, more on that in a moment, and partnering up with this guy, Justin Gallivan.
I am a card-carrying chemist at Emory University. This is like an arranged marriage that seems to have worked very well. So.
Gallivan's also a pretty good amateur chef, and he's gotten into using things from his chemistry lab in the kitchen, which just thrills the two chefs at Kimball House. For instance, when Gallivan entered the restaurant kitchen that evening, he came bearing gifts. He'd taken ground-up toasted pecans and run them through his centrifuge.
This was spun at about 10,000 times the force of gravity, and what that does is it basically moves the heavy stuff to the bottom.
And the lighter stuff moves to the top.
So you start getting a separation, and on the top, you can actually see this nut cream.
Oh my God, this is insane.
A middle layer is pure pecan oil.
It smells like a pecan pie. Take a sniff of that.
Oh my God.
The chefs instantly assimilate the new taste into their flavor repertoire and incorporate it into the salad course. I should say that the term salad is used rather loosely around here.
Think Monet, you know, the beautiful lily-like paintings.
Philip Meeker wants to make the salad look like a pond. Juiced vegetables,
romaine, celery, fennel,
form the green pond water. Nasturtium leaves have become mini lily pads, and it's finished off with a couple drops of Gallivan's pecan oil. The result really does look like a pond on my plate. Gallivan is grinning.
Well, I just got a bit of the pecan oil, and it's just fantastic. It's just bursting with pecan flavor.
Chef Jeffrey Wall is just as pleased.
To be able to execute clean flavors like this that are so concentrated is what everybody wants in the culinary world.
What does chemistry have to do with cooking?
I think everything. Cooking is a constant battle with learning how food works, and food is chemistry.
Case in point, the final dish in our 7-course meal.
This is the duck that we fed figs and almonds to make them nice and flavorful and fat.
Feeding ducks figs is a 4,000-year-old technique.
Meeker and Wall worked up the duck in four different ways. First, a roulade made by rolling up the breast inside the skin and searing it to caramelize the exterior. Chemist Justin Gallivan.
Caramelization is basically heating sugars to very, very high temperatures. There's also browning reactions that are collectively known as the Maillard reaction that are also associated with producing flavors and some of the colors.
The second preparation is a duck mousse made from pureeing the legs and tenderloins with creme fraiche and a touch of nutmeg.
We're just transforming matter from one state into another, and whether it's transforming molecules from A to B or transforming this duck to some remarkable dish, it's all chemistry.
Third, a homemade ravioli made from ricotta, bok choy, and duck leg confit. That confit was cooked using a modernist technique called sous vide.
So sous vide is a process in which food is cooked in a water bath to a very precise temperature. And you let it sit and it will equilibrate. And it cannot overcook.
And the final preparation.
The pastrami that we made, and then put it on some toast with some fig jam and almonds. Full circle, you know, we wanted it to eat figs and almonds, and then we wanted to serve it with figs and almonds. And we had high-tech equipment to cook all this at perfect temperatures, and then yet it's a 4,000-year-old technique, so enjoy.
The preparations of duck are displayed on a long dish, each one a swirl of form, color, and aroma. What's happening in this kitchen is a deep blend of science and art. Chef Philip Meeker.
We try to take many different viewpoints. We think about maybe a song, and we think about this flavor's parallels to notes, or we'll think about a nice poem by Ezra Pound. It's always good to find inspiration everywhere and to have your mind open.
In finding inspiration in music, poetry, and chemistry, the result at Kimball House is unforgettable. Literally, this is probably the best meal of my life.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Ari Daniel is a freelance producer. That story comes from the series Small Matters, produced by the Center for Chemical Evolution and sponsored by the National Science Foundation, with additional support from NASA. That old saying, give a man a fish and he eats for a day, give him a fishing pole and he'll feed himself? Well, the Scandinavians take that wisdom a step beyond. Teach a man to cure a fish and he eats for a lifetime. If you want to know every which way to keep a fish delicious for months, even years, head to Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Finland. Those seas that surround them are their gold in the bank. Splendid Table contributor David Leet talked to Paul Lowe, a cookbook author, lifestyle guru, and magazine publisher. He's affectionately known as Sweet Paul.
Paul, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So in Norway, where you're from, it seems as if there is this national imperative of ye must preserve fish. So where does this come from? What's the practicality behind this? What is the tradition and heritage behind this?
Well, you got to remember that we were used to be a very poor country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's before we struck oil, and now we're one of the richest countries in the world. And fish was a very important food source for us. And, you know, in order to ship that fish, you know, further into the country, we had to come up with ways to preserve it.
Okay.
So, you know, smoking and salting and pickling and all kinds of things. So it became something very important for us.
So in your book and your magazines, you talk about four basic ways, which is curing, smoking, salting, and drying.
Yes.
And you also say in your book that your grandmother, whom you call Mormor, Mormor, used to make gravlax with aquavit.
Yes.
Now, can you, that's a marvelous dish. Can you just take us through that process of what it's like?
Well, she was actually very famous for her gravlax.
Really?
Yes. She would use two big sides of salmon, skin on, and then she would make this mixture of equally amounts of sugar and salt, and there was tons of dill, there was grated lemon zest, there was red peppercorns, and then she would pack this on top of one of the sides of salmon, and she would put the other one on top, and then she would drizzle it with aquavit.
Interesting.
And then she would press it and put it into the fridge.
And what did she press it with?
She would just use what do I call, like building blocks, like
cinder blocks?
Yes, exactly. And she would turn it every day and drizzle more aquavits over it. And after 3 days, she would take it out and she would scrape off most of, you know, the herbs and slice it up really thin. And she would serve it with this amazingly sweet mustard sauce and dark rye bread. I have to say, it was really divine.
So let's talk a little bit about smoking. Mm. Give me some ideas so I can get me some really good smoked fish. First of all, what kind of fish would you use and how would you smoke it?
Well, you would use an oily fish. Mm-hmm. So it needs to be fatty.
Such as?
So, mackerel, trout, salmon, of course. Perfect. Mm-hmm. I find it the easiest to do it on a gas grill.
Okay.
And you will buy these smoke boxes.
Yes.
It's these cast iron boxes that you can put in your grill. You have to remember to use only the side burners.
Which means indirect heat.
Indirect heat, yes. And you use hickory chips that you have to soak. And you put it in the box and then put in the fish. And then you just have to wait.
And it's on a low setting?
Yes. The temperature inside needs to be between 160 and 180 degrees.
Okay.
And it will take, you know, depending on how big your fish is, it will take between 1 and 3 hours.
So you're doing hot smoking because it's...
I am doing hot smoking because cold smoking is a little more like a process.
Exactly.
And I find that hot smoking is the easiest thing to do at home.
Right. Because it also smokes and cooks the fish.
Exactly. And it just gives you this, like, the fish just... You know, the meat will come very tender, very moist, and it sort of, it falls off. It almost becomes like spreadable.
And how would you serve this marvelous smoked fish? Cold, what would you have accompaniments?
Well, I remember when I was a kid, we served it with small potatoes, fingerling potatoes, a cucumber salad, which is just cucumber sliced and mixed with vinegar, a little water, and lemon juice and some sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, lots of dill and sour cream.
It's wonderful.
It's like the perfect summer meal because it's so light, it's so fresh, you know, it's a little salty.
Right.
It's divine.
Drying is also another technique that you use to preserve fish. Tell me a little bit about drying.
Well, our biggest tradition is, of course, the cod that makes bacalao.
Yeah, which we call in Portugal bacalhau.
Yes. They do it up, you know, in the north of Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of amazing because they catch the fish.
Yes.
Chop off the head, they slice it in half up to the tail, they will salt it, and then they will hang it on these drying racks that are all along the coast. And the sight is just, it's incredible. It's really incredible. And it hangs there until it's dried.
So when you have this dried fish, how do you prepare it so you can eat it? Obviously it's dry, so you have to reconstitute it.
Yes, of course. You have to water it out.
Okay.
So you have to soak it in water until the meat becomes soft.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of amazing to see because the meat actually becomes like beautiful, tender, flaky. It's an amazing product and it's not that much used anymore. It's sort of like some of those old vegetables kind of people forgot about. And I feel like dried cod is one of those things.
You mentioned that pickling is another way of preserving fish, which is fascinating to me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, pickled herring is huge. And I remember as a kid, I could actually eat pickled herring directly from the jar.
Really?
Yes. My grandmother wasn't a big fan, but my mother loved it. So she would do the herring pickling in our family.
Mm-hmm.
And she would buy fresh herring that she deboned and cleaned. And then she would make this brine out of salt and sugar and all kinds of spices. Like
dill
mustard
too.
Seeds, tons of dill.
Of course.
I'm from Norway, so, you know, we love our dill. And lots of onions.
Okay.
Then we would serve it on flatbread with more onion and sour cream.
Oh, that sounds
always
wonderful.
Sour cream.
Oh, Paul, you've got me hungry.
Well, that's good.
I want to thank you for coming on the show. It was an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you.
Paulo is author of the cooking and craft book Eat and Make, as well as the publisher of Sweet Paul magazine. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Now, Paul left us with that recipe for the simplest of simple preserved fish, his grandmother's aquavit cured salmon with mustard sauce. And David, with his Portuguese heritage, was not going to be left out, so you can find his salt cod and crab fritters as well. All for you, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the tradition of frog's legs in Detroit and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Long before Detroit was known for its cars and for its music, the city was legendary for one thing: frog legs. In the early 1900s, Detroit restaurants offered just about any variation imaginable. Frog leg salad, frog ravioli, even frog pie. People were crazy for them, and President Grover Cleveland even called them his favorite meal. Well, contributor Fred Opie spoke to Detroit food historian Bill Loomis for the story.
Well, Bill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So tell me, what role did frog legs play in turn of the century Detroit?
They were a really important source of money and food in Detroit. Detroit was known across the country as the place to get frog legs. Detroit-style frog legs were highly prized.
You know, if you think about Detroit frog legs and where they came from, would you say it's a case of working-class culture making its influence on white tablecloth restaurants, or vice versa, you know, bottom-up or top-down?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was bottom-up, but it was a carryover from the French days of Detroit, and it was sort of the last vestige of French cuisine. So all of the fishing was done, or most of the fishing was done professionally by French Canadians. And it constituted a portion of the diet that included other wild game like muskrat and freshwater fish like perch and stuff like that. But that's where it really came from. There weren't French chefs. In fact, if you look at the display ads in the Detroit papers from the turn of the century, they'll say in the hotels, our frog legs taste just like roadhouse frog legs. And the roadhouses were where you know, it was fairly rough and rugged type of food, very casual, and not at all formal, not your white tablecloth stuff.
You know, it was interesting when I looked at a longer piece that you did on the same topic that you said that Detroit had this reputation of shipping something like 12 tons of frog legs. I mean, that was hard for me to wrap my mind around. That's unbelievable. Is that industry, is it a mom-and-pop industry, or did it become kind of an industrial food factory?
You know, it started out strictly as kind of a wild game mom-and-pop thing where people, like I said, French-Canadian men would go out, and families would go out and hunt frog legs and bring them into the restaurants and the roadhouses. But after a while, if you look at the old Wall Street journals, they talk about the industry, and it was a national industry, but they were done on farms, frog farms. And the number, I thought it was eye-popping myself, but if you look at interviews of restaurants in Detroit, they did a lot of press coverage on frog legs. People were always kind of curious about it. But they would do 1,000 dozen a week during the season, which ran from April all the way to or through October, depending how warm it was. So they were doing, I estimated, roughly 200,000 to 400,000 frog legs per restaurant. And there were hundreds of these places, roadhouses, hotels, restaurants that were selling frog legs. They also were shipping them to Chicago and to the East Coast, so they weren't just consuming all those frog legs.
Was there something distinctive about how you would make frog legs or prepare frog legs in Detroit versus the places where they were shipping to, say, a place like New York? Any sense of that?
You know, there was. Detroit-style frog legs were nationally famous. In fact, Grover Cleveland's favorite dish was Detroit-style frog legs. They were basically very simple. They would roll them in egg wash and then roll them in cracker crumbs and fry them in butter. Those were called roadhouse style. Other styles were cooked in butter and fried, but they might add tomatoes or mushrooms or something like that. But generally, it was very simple.
So, Bill, frog legs were, you know, the in thing at the turn of the century. What
right.
happened?
You know, that's what's so amazing about this, Fred, is that they just overloved them. Like a lot of other wild animals, turtles and things like that. They just ate them till they were gone. So they moved from Detroit, the source of them, to Wisconsin, and then they overfished that. But also the water quality went way down. With the industrialization of Detroit, suddenly the river was changing, and that sort of killed it as well. But what's interesting is if you talk to people that are, say, over 40 or 50, many of them have memories of eating frog legs at a lot of restaurants in these places along the Detroit River still. If you talk to younger people, they've never had them. Not only that, they're kind of repulsed at the whole idea of eating them. So you have this huge gap that happened over just a few decades.
So are, you know, there's a lot of things that are becoming resurgent on the table, and I hear great things about new chefs coming into Detroit, particularly because it's a lot less expensive to set up a, you know, a pop-up or a brick-and-mortar place. Are you seeing them back on the menu?
I do see them. I don't know if it's a resurgence like it is at the same level as we're seeing all the restaurants opening in Detroit, but definitely there are places in Detroit that are selling them. The resurgence, oddly enough, started out of Windsor, Ontario, across the river, and they're seeing a lot of popularity in frog legs, so we're kind of hoping it'll spill over to Detroit.
Well, Bill, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, Brad.
Bill Loomis is the author of Detroit's Delectable Past and Detroit Food. His article, When Frogs Were King, appeared in the 2014 edition of Our Detroit. Food historian Fred Opie is author of Hog and Hominy. Now, if you're inspired to give those frog legs a try, we've posted a recipe for traditional Detroit frog legs and the Leaping Frog cocktail. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, anything you can do with a frog's leg, you can do with a chicken wing. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. Listeners call in and give us five ingredients that are really in their fridge. Now, I know nothing about those ingredients. My job is to take those five ingredients, plus a few others, and make a dish that they would really want to try making themselves. They either pass me or they fail me. Now, in addition to the five ingredients, I get water, salt, pepper, and some kind of fat, plus three ingredients that they really have in their house. We also have a twist here. Every month, USA Weekend is going to be publishing this recipe along with a photo, and you'll also be able to find it on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, who's our contestant this week? We've got Cheryl calling from Marietta, Georgia. Cheryl, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn. So nice to be here.
Now, I want you to attest that you and I have had no contact and that I have no idea what's in your refrigerator.
That's correct.
All right. Now, what five things? And make them easy, please.
Okay. Cream cheese.
Okay. Yeah.
Brussels sprouts.
Okay.
Cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
Celery. And onion.
All right. I want some... Do you have olive oil?
Okay.
All right. I'm going to use salt and pepper, and I'm going to use some water. And... Ooh, you know what's going to be good here?
What's that?
Do you have fresh lemon?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, okay.
A drawerful.
All right, drawerful lemons. That's one ingredient.
Okay.
Got garlic?
Oh, absolutely.
Love it. Is this woman a cook or is this woman a cook? Okay, and then I think the third thing is going to be I'd like some sugar.
Some sugar, okay.
Yeah, you've got sugar, right?
Real sugar or Splenda?
Regular sugar.
Regular sugar, okay.
Okay, this is what we're going to do. We are going to finely slice the celery, cook it in, you know, slice it into thin slices.
Okay.
All right? And we're going to take the onion, and we're going to take one medium onion, and we're going to cut it into maybe half-inch dice. You're going to take your Brussels sprouts, and you're going to cut each Brussels sprout from top to bottom into three slices, okay?
Okay.
And then you're going to toss those with olive oil, with salt and pepper, and the grated zest of the lemon rind.
Ooh, wonderful.
Okay, so you've got onion, you've got the sliced celery, uh-huh. right? And you've got the Brussels sprouts.
Right.
Now you're going to take the oven, put it at about 450, spread those out on a pan, and you're going to roast them and turn them and roast them until those Brussels sprouts are golden brown and they're tender and they just taste wonderful. You may have to lower the heat a little bit. You don't want them to burn. Now you're going to make a sauce. And what you're going to do is you are going to take more onion, okay, minced onion.
Uh-huh.
You're going to brown it slow in okay. olive oil. You're going to stir in sugar, okay?
How much sugar?
I would say probably if you've got half of a medium onion that you've minced up and you're sautéing it in, let's say, 2 tablespoons or so of olive oil, I would add another tablespoon of sugar. Don't let it burn. Just stir it in.
Okay.
Add about 3 cloves of minced garlic. Cook that down very gently. You don't want it to burn. And then take it off the heat and stir in the cream cheese.
Ooh, okay.
And you want to stir in that cream cheese until it's really creamy. It's going to get creamy with that heat. And if you need to, add a little bit of water to it.
Okay.
Taste it for salt and pepper, and then add enough fresh lemon to make it sweet sour. So you've got this creamy, tangy cream cheese sauce with browned onion, all right, and you take out the roasted Brussels sprouts, you mound them on a platter, and you streak this sauce in zigzags over the top.
Oh.
And the cucumber would be the cool finish. You would dice that cucumber, seed it, small dice, and that gets sprinkled over everything because the crunch of the cool, fresh cucumber with the earthy Brussels sprouts and the creamy sauce is going to be fabulous.
Right. There are going to be some Brussels sprouts that are jealous that they don't have some sauce on them.
Well, would you make it? Do I win?
Oh, absolutely. That's fabulous.
Thank
all the
you.
Ingredients that I love the best. Just, oh, that's wonderful, Lynn. Thank you so much.
Oh, Cheryl, thank you. And I'm blushing. Thanks for playing Stump the Cook.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You can find that recipe for crispy roast Brussels sprouts and celery with tangy cream cheese drizzle that I dreamed up for Cheryl in USA Weekend, as well as at usaweekend.com. Now, if you want to play Stump the Cook, head to the website, splendidtable.org.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said, look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
We're connecting with you. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. We're on Facebook and Twitter. And, of course, you can send us an email. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see who is up. Mike's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Mike, what's up?
Hey, I'd like to talk to you about BLTs.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Every year, my girlfriend and I throw a BLT party. I love BLTs. The best time of the year to get tomatoes, obviously, is now. And so that's kind of the star for me. Some people will say it's bacon, but I think it's really the tomato.
Uh-huh.
And this is the third one we've done so far, and it's kind of turned into a celebration of summer. And, you know, there's 5 ingredients to a BLT, obviously the bacon, loaf, tomato, we got the bread and the condiments. And from each of those, we kind of just go all out.
For right.
Bacon, we cure our own, we slice it, we do candied bacon for the tomatoes, we get some really great heirlooms, we do fried green tomatoes with the bacon fat, a dozen different condiments with spicy honey, sriracha aioli, all those sorts of things.
Oh, this sounds
fabulous.
So I'm
just kind of curious to hear any ideas. I mean, like we had a pastry chef who was a friend of ours make slider rolls. We keep everything about slider size just so everybody can enjoy, you know, three or four of them. And this year in particular is going to be a little bit special because I'm going to propose.
You are?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, is there a slider roll that could have a little indentation in it and there's a ring in it?
You know, I didn't think about that.
Then again, she might bite into the ring and do damage to her tooth.
Yeah, don't want to break a tooth.
Although,
but we
know,
love entertaining. We have, I'm probably going to have about 50 friends and family coming, you know, flying in and from the area. So
this sounds like the best party. What a fabulous
yes,
idea.
It's going to be fun.
But as far as condiments, okay, yeah. Tell me what fruits are coming in now in your neck of the woods.
Well, our neighbor has a fig tree. They're not as sweet. That's called the brown turkey figs.
Right.
They're not quite as sweet as, a Black Mission.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. But, you know, being in the South, we have lots of different things. I'll caramelize some nice Vidalia onions that are not far
what
away.
What about peaches, nectarines?
Peaches, yeah. Peaches are fantastic right now.
Because what about caramelizing?
Sorghum.
Did you just say sorghum?
I did.
Wow. What about the idea?
We did sorghum mustard last year.
How about wedges of underripe peaches or nectarines or both that you brush with that sorghum, sprinkle with black pepper, and lightly grill?
Oh, my God.
And that goes on a plate that you can just plop that on top of. That's one of your condiments right there. What berries are coming in? Any interesting berries?
We've got some, let's see, interesting ones. Well, we've got the, you know, your typical blackberries, blueberries.
Yeah, your good old-fashioned delicious.
Yeah.
All right. How about...
I can't really think of anything that's really exotic.
Make a pickle brine for sweet pickles. Mm-hmm. You know, like icebox pickles.
Okay.
So it's vinegar, sugar, cooked a bit. There's some water in there. There's spices. And then drop those raspberry, blueberry, whatever, and let them sit for a day or two in that brine.
Mm.
And then you've got pickled berries. And those can be drained and put out, and those can be used as a condiment as well. I'm just trying to think because, boy, you've come up with such fabulous stuff.
I'm always open to more.
And
it doesn't have to be condiments.
Bacon.
You know, last year we did a few different types of bread, some brioche, some waffles. I mean, really, any of those five ingredients, any kind of take on any of those.
How about making blini?
Blini? I haven't even thought about that.
Yeah, blini.
That's
and you
fantastic.
Can make buckwheat blini. And then you just split them and you fill them. The idea of a pancake is just super. The other thing is a kind of sturdy cornbread, not a crumbly one. That may be more for an open face idea, but wouldn't cornbread be really sensational with all those flavors?
It really would be.
Oh, and with the grilled peach, sorghum, whatever, somewhere in there. And the tomato. I mean, oh, yeah. And then how about changing around some of the lettuces? You could do watercress, which is really peppery.
Uh-huh.
And really assertive, and you could do arugula and any kind of wild greens you've got. They would be great. Something that really has a lot of character and kick.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy, that would be fabulous. I think that's a lot of stuff, but I just like the idea of a slider engagement ring holder. I somehow feel that may have a future. Hey, have a great party, and thanks for a great idea.
Thank you so much.
I'm rolling it around in my head and looking at our backyard right now in my head.
Sounds great.
Hey,
I'll send you photos.
and much happiness to you both.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thank you, Lynn.
We're going to be back in a minute with more of your questions and, hey, your kitchen countertops, some easy changes for a stylish kitchen.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Rehab from the folks at Remodelista. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're talking with you this hour. Let's get back to your questions. Connect with us at 800-537-5252 and check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Heron's on the line from Omaha. Heron, have I pronounced your name correctly?
You have, Lynn. Thank you.
Oh, that's fabulous. Unusual name. Where's that from?
Well, I have my mom to thank for that one.
Hey, so what do you want to talk about?
Well, me and my girlfriend moved to Omaha about close to a year ago now. And we were very happily surprised to find a large Mexican population in the city. And so there's, you know, tons of meat markets and cuts of meat that I've never had available to me before.
Right.
So I was hoping you could maybe give me some pointers on how to cook some tongue. I've seen like oxtail and tripe and all sorts of stuff I've never had before. So just hoping you can give me some ideas.
Well, okay. First of all, the tongue. Now, this is one of those things where a lot of people say, ugh, it's fabulous. It is delicious.
Totally.
No, it's really great. And one way that I've done it, and I think is, and again, I'm not sure if this is going to be a traditional way that it might be done by a Mexican family, but it's going to help you achieve what you need to achieve with it. Tongue needs to be cooked with moisture, usually lightly poached. And here's the deal with tongue. First of all, there's a coating on it. There's a skin, okay? It's like, you know, when you get a hunk of pork and there's a skin over the fat. So what you do is, it probably will have already been cleaned. And if that's the case, fine. But if not, the tongue, you just make a long slit and you slip off that skin. It's very, very easy. And often at the thick end of the tongue, there's some cartilage at the underneath part that you can cut away. Now, what you want to do is you want to cook that in a really flavorful broth. And one thing that I did at one point was that I cooked some fabulous chicken parts that I had saved in the freezer to make a chicken stock with a lot of vegetables. And then I just threw the tongue in that as it cooked. And I had a little white wine and a lot of garlic. And so the tongue gave some flavor to the broth, which I could then strain and freeze. But yeah, I mean, you know, so I had two things for the price of one. And I got this really tender tongue. Simmer it so that there's barely a bubble in the liquid. And if you want to just take some canned broth, you could, with a bit of wine, you could throw in some chilies, some garlic, some oregano, you know, some of those flavors you're going to want later anyway. And then once it's tender, and you want it at about 160 degrees in the center, and you want to hold it at that temperature for about 45 minutes maybe to make sure it's really tender, you let it cool. And then what you can do is that you can coat it with what is sometimes called a chili colorado, meaning a red chili sauce. And if you want to be really authentic, are you, if you're in groceries, you're seeing a lot of dried chilies, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, tons of them.
Oh, okay, okay. This is what one of the things you can do, all right? Let's start at the beginning. You're going to take some dried guajillo chilies, G-U-A-J-I-L-L-O, and some dried ancho chilies. And and what you're going to do is you're going to put them on top of the stove or on your grill is better. Do you do a lot of grilling?
I do, yeah. I've got a charcoal grill.
Oh, that's great. You're going to take like three of each and the whole chili, and you're going to put it on the grill as it's cooling down after you've cooked something just for a few moments until you can smell the chili. It's going to, you're going to smell this smell, okay? Put it aside, let it cool. And then what I do is I seed it. I break off the stem and I seed it. Now, if once I seed it, I've removed some of the heat. And then I soak that in water to cover about 20, 30 minutes. Drain off the water, throw it in a blender. I add usually a bit of garlic, some oregano, and sometimes a little cumin and ground coriander.
Awesome.
That is your chili sauce.
That's delicious.
Now, cut up big, nice slices like the size, a bit thicker than your finger, of the cooked tongue.
roll it around in that chili sauce, stick it in the fridge overnight. And the next day, you put those little fingers on your grill. You don't want to burn them, but you want to just get them seared. All that nice chili flavor in there. You put them into a small corn tortilla that you've just warmed, okay? Put a little fresh lime juice on that and a little bit of chopped onion and a few sprigs of fresh coriander, also known as cilantro. And you are eating like a king.
Oh, great. Thank you so much, Lynn.
That's great. And by the way, same method. Chicken, beef. Those things could have been roasted. They could be leftovers. But that same method. And it works like a charm.
That is a great method.
Yeah. And by the way, look at books by Rick Bayless. Okay?
Rick Bayless.
Great writer. Makes it simple. You can see him on PBS. He's one place to begin. And then the woman who's obsessed with authenticity, Diana Kennedy. And now, go forth. You are in nirvana there in Omaha.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Andy just tweeted us with this question. He wants to design a four-course meal to represent the Emilia-Romagna region of northern Italy. Well, I mean, this is not a plant, but I spent about 10 years researching this region, so I've got a few ideas. Andy, you want to begin with, I think, really good mortadella in cubes with bits of cherry tomato. So you have a cherry tomato and a little cube of the mortadella, and you put it on a skewer. And you serve that with drinks. And the ideal thing to have is perhaps a Negroni, or you may want to just drink a glass of a really nice, crisp Sauvignon Blanc. Okay, after that, pasta. You've got to have a course of pasta. And the great classic is ragu bolognese. There happens to be a recipe for a classic ragu bolognese with tagliatelle. That's the correct pasta to serve with it. In a book called The Splendid Table. And it may actually be on our website. Another alternative is to just toss the pasta, okay, tagliatelle, with slivers of prosciutto, a ton of fresh herbs, basil, parsley, thyme, rosemary, and some sautéed pancetta and lots of black pepper. That's a really simple way to go. Oh, with Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese. How could we forget? Now, from there, you're going to need something that's protein. One of the great things that you can do is you pound out pork chops. You treat them essentially like veal scallopini, but you're doing it with pork instead. You can pound out pork chops. You can actually do them, leave them on the bone so that you end up with this great curved bone. You pound them, and then what you do is you salt and pepper them, and you dip them in egg and a bit of flour, and you pan brown them. And you would serve that with crisp roasted carrots that you've just drizzled with balsamic vinegar and a big green salad, simply done with just oil and vinegar. And that would be a great main dish. And with that, you'd want to drink a Sangiovese. All right, this is from Romagna. And for dessert, you've got to have what I call Modena crumbling cake. This is really light. You have it with coffee. Take any biscuit recipe, okay, and double up on the butter in the biscuit and add sugar to it. So for every 2 cups of flour, you're going to be adding about 4 tablespoons of sugar. And then you want every 2 cups of flour in the recipe, you want the grated zest of half a lemon. And what you do is you make a biscuit, but you pat it out into a large rectangle, and down the center of it, what you do is you put apricot jam. You just spread it. Roll over the sides, okay, so that essentially you are making a long tube, and bake it off. And you serve this in thin slices with espresso coffee. And I call it Modena crumbling cake because it turns into big fat crumbs and you have to squeeze them with your fingers from the tablecloth and they're just delicious. And by the way, some people drink sweet red wine with this as well. So there's your four-course meal from Emilia Romagna in way more than 140 characters. But that said, follow us on Twitter. We have Donnell on the line from Crestline, California. Is it Crestline?
It's Crestline Lake.
Crestline.
Yes.
Are you up in the mountains?
I am up in the mountains.
All right.
No mountains. It's beautiful.
Oh, that sounds gorgeous. Hey, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Well, we're a small community, and I was driving home the other day from work, and I saw someone was selling goose eggs. And I got so excited, but I realized I have no idea what to do with them.
You make very large omelets.
Well, that's what I thought.
But they're really, have you tasted it yet?
Not yet.
Okay, because they're really rich.
And really? Okay.
Yeah, they're really rich. And they're really kind of tasty. And yes, they make a fabulous frittata or an omelet. I have a friend who uses them in baking. And especially anywhere, like if she's making a pound cake, someplace where it's basically a kind of rich recipe, the goose eggs give it a real lovely dimension of taste. But, you know, the average, most recipes when they say one egg mean a large egg.
Right.
And a large egg weighs about 2 ounces. So if you've got it, most recipes are not going to call for goose eggs.
Right.
You know, it's not the thing you usually call for. But this is what you can do is you can, if you have a little scale, you can weigh your egg.
Okay.
And so, you know, if the recipe says 6 eggs, that's 12 ounces. And you want 12 ounces of whatever the goose eggs add up to. Were they very large?
No, they weren't very large.
You know what I would do? Seriously. I'd buy, I don't know, 4 of them, maybe even half a dozen, and I'd scramble up one. Just keep it really simple. You know, scramble it gently, very slowly, a little salt and pepper, maybe put it in a teeny bit of butter, and then see what it tastes like.
That does make sense.
And the other thing is that if you hard cook them, you know, slow simmer for about, maybe 8 minutes or so, and then let them cool in the water, and you shell them, what might be a fun thing to do is to try deviled eggs with them.
Oh.
And maybe deviled eggs with a little bit of cut up cold shrimp that you've sprinkled with lemon. Because if the eggs are rich, you want something acidic, something to contrast.
Right.
And you want something a little bit crunchy. So I would do finely chopped celery or, you know, something on that order.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I think that could be really tasty, don't you?
Yes.
And then you could serve, if they're large enough, you could serve a main course, deviled egg.
Sounds wonderful.
You know, when they get to be the size of an avocado, just think what you can do with that. But I think it's, you know, the only way you're going to find out is by buy a couple and do the simplest preparation with them and see what you get.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome. I wish I lived in a town where I could get goose eggs.
You're really lucky. Surprise me.
Hey, enjoy, Donnell, and thanks for a great call.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. What does a trained architect see when they look at a kitchen? In one word, possibilities. Christine Hanway is the UK editor of Remodelista.com, a digital guide to remodeling and home design that's all about the mix, the high and the low. Sally Swift got together with Christine to talk about ideas for quick kitchen fixes that don't include plaster dust and new appliances.
Christine, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Sally. It's great to be here.
So I want to talk to you today about some quick fixes for the kitchen for those of us that aren't ready to take out walls. What are you seeing trend-wise that we can change in our kitchens?
Well, we're seeing lots of things. One of the easiest things to do is to pull off the cabinet faces on the uppers, because there's a big trend right now in open shelving,
mm-hmm.
and you don't want to take all your kitchen cabinets off and put in up install new shelving. Very simply, you can just remove the cabinet front, mm-hmm. and you can do other interesting things like paint the backs of those cabinets,
mm-hmm.
or you could wallpaper them. I think it makes people think about what they want on display.
Hmm.
So maybe it's just your favorite glasses, the glasses that get used all the time, the ones that can go in the dishwasher, the ones that the kids can, you know, use.
Mm-hmm. And what about all of this? I think that I'm seeing a lot more fabric in kitchens in a way, doors missing and fabric being hung instead. Is that part of the same trend?
Yeah, I guess it's that sort of farmhouse aesthetic or that French country kitchen,
mm-hmm.
Underneath the sink. It's just a curtain. There is no door. But alternatively, you know, you can do it in front of a tall pantry and hang a beautiful piece of fabric or curtain to soften things up. I imagine it must help acoustically, too.
Yeah, I would think it would, too. What about for those of us who hate our countertops? Is there a quick fix for something that we can do without having to install new ones?
Yeah. A colleague of mine, she was in a rental, and she didn't like the granite countertops. And so basically she just went and got some plywood and had a carpenter build plywood countertops for her.
And like just laid them on top of the existing?
She laid them on top, and then she built returns on them.
Huh.
Yeah, no, they look really, really good. She's very pleased with them, actually.
Huh. And what about, how do you feel about lighting? Is there an easy way for people to fix lighting in their kitchens?
I think with lighting, it's all about layering. So, you know, whether it's clothes or your furnishings, sort of the more layering you can do, the better off you are. So you can have your recessed lights, but it's also good to have some task lights or under counter lighting. But if you don't want to install under counter lighting, a few clip-on lights work really, really well.
Really cheap, and you can put them anywhere, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of lighting, I think if you're going to do one thing, it would be a pendant. It would be either a big pendant or a series of maybe three pendants over either your dining room table or your kitchen island, wherever it is that you and your friends and family congregate. I think of pendant lights like creating like your own little fireplace, like a hearth in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense, and you get that beautiful pool of light, and everyone's focused in that pool.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, this is a personal question, if you were going to invest in one thing in your kitchen, what would it be? Would it be an oven? Would it be a good refrigerator? Where would you go?
I think with big kitchen fixes, anything is worth it if it helps you enjoy being in the kitchen, because we're in the kitchen so much.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, having a big, beautiful sculptural sink is what makes my time in the kitchen better, because I'm always standing at it, whether I'm washing the dishes or I'm preparing the vegetables.
Mm-hmm. And do you like a single bowl sink or do you like a divided?
I like a single bowl sink.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a practical thing, but for me, when you're washing a big pot, I hate it when you're in its tiny little sink and it just keeps banging against everything.
Yeah, that's funny. I think people don't think very much about kitchen sinks. I think they're pretty important as well. Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sally.
Christine Hanway is the UK editor of Remodelista. Now, take a look at the book, Remodelista, A Manual for the Considered Home. Info is at splendidtable.org. Well, thanks for listening. That's our show for this week. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Alfred Hitchcock, who said, "Some of our most exquisite murders have been domestic, performed with tenderness in simple, homey places, like the kitchen table." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Head to the Splendid Table website, splendidtable.org, to find information on anything you heard here today. Get recipes for any occasion. Register for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and take a look at our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.